Project, we are throwing it back today to March 2019 with Eric Goodman. Eric Goodman is the founder of Foundations, which is basically a back rehabilitation program, but it's a slightly different approach to the back. It's a slightly different philosophy than, say, a Stuart McGill when it comes to fixing the back. It's almost a counter to Stuart McGill, but regardless, if he's fixing backs, it's working. And yeah, this is a great interview with Eric. I really enjoyed the conversation. I think he's got some really good insights for people that have maybe tried some stuff for healing your back or fixing your back and it hasn't worked.
Yeah, no, it's perfect timing because a lot of the poses he uses, pretty much the whole program, you could do at home.
Yep.
So it's really like it's an isolation-friendly program. And some of the reviews he gets are insane. It is one of the most popular back programs in the entire world. I've never had back issues that have caused me to do a program like this, but people around the world have had unbelievably good transformations from it. So it's worth a listen.
Absolutely. And guys, supporting the podcast today is True Protein. They are the best supplements, definitely in Australia. And I'd argue the whole world, although it's challenging to try all the supplements in the world. But if you go to trueprotein.com.au, use our code MINDMUSCLE10 when you check out, you get any of their store for 10% off. Now, if I have to make a recommendation, recently I have been smashing the salted caramel True Protein bars. It's just so convenient. I mean, obviously whey protein is convenient, but if you want something that's like even more delicious, then you get a protein bar. And obviously, you know, Raf and I are huge fans of protein bars. Well, this one in particular, what I like about it is it's just got the best ingredients. So clean ingredients, obviously super affordable and just delicious. And I just sincerely hope that in the future they are in petrol stations. Mm. But then also my bank account also sincerely hopes they're not. So guys, check that out. TrueProtein.com.au, MindMuscle10 when you check out, gets you 10% off any order. Here we are with Eric Goodman.
This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raf Friedman, and you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project.
All right, Mind Muscle Project, welcome back to another episode. We're actually christening the first digital episode in the new studio. Today we have Eric Goodman, who is well-known best-selling author for his back rehab stuff and kind of figuring out how the world can be less pain-free when it comes to their backs, which is, you know, undoubtedly the most troublesome area in the human body as we speak. I just call it desk back because that's usually what it's related to. People just chronically sitting at desks. So
I call it CrossFit back for me.
So it's actually really interesting. I thought the best place to start this before we dive into a little bit of your background and story, Eric, is if someone has, I'm just speak for myself here, but what I've seen is someone has chronic back pain that never seems to go away and you seem to do everything right. Maybe they're pain-free for a little bit, but then they go back to the things that they want to do, lifting or running or whatever it is, and the pain comes back straight away. I feel after a certain period of time, it is like almost entirely psychological. Where do you sit on that spectrum? Is it a physical thing that's not, or is it just a mental health issue at that point?
That's actually a really good question to start with. Have you ever heard of Dr. John Sarno?
I haven't, no.
Sarno, S-A-R-N-O. He's brilliant. He died a few years ago, so you're not going to meet him. But
that sucks.
Right? His work, however, is on the far, far end of that spectrum of this is psychosomatic. You are creating your own pain, and this is simply a pattern that you have convinced yourself on a very subconscious level to follow. I recommend anybody that is suffering chronic pain look into his work. It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. He's a medical doctor. He's the guy that would never, ever say that based on training and then through experience well into his 90s was actively telling people that.
Mm.
So I'm in the middle of the spectrum, personally. I've seen too many people get better through physicality to believe that it's entirely mental. And I've seen the same thing that works for a lot of people not work for certain people. And then they go through some life-changing event that makes them feel confident. That's the biggie. It's confidence. When that life-changing event gives them a new sense of confidence, self-worth, establishes their strength in a different way, I would argue that a lot of that is mental. And who cares, as long as they get better.
Yeah,
that's the reality of it. If you're really in this to help people, you're not trying to help them just with your thing. You're trying to help them. And sometimes you have to point people away from the thing you know so well. For me, that's foundation training, which is an entirely movement-based protocol for rehabilitation and pain relief, towards something like Dr. Sarno and many others. You know, Dr. Joe Dispenza is another very interesting one in that field. Man, placebo is so real, and thank God.
Yeah, right. So let's jump back a few steps. It's good. It's a good kind of, I think, bit of context to kind of set people up to as to where you stand on that issue. Because, you know, we've had Stuart McGill on the podcast, who you know before, and it's kind of a topic we dived into and had some interesting ideas in it. But how did you get obsessed with backs? How did you end up down this path of helping people with their spine?
Very personal endeavor. I have a messed up spine. It's the only reason I have a program. I've developed all of my work to avoid fusion surgery in my own lower back. And I've been, you know, fighting that fight, I would say, since I was 27 years old. Let me apologize real quick to your audience if they're looking at me sweating. I just finished a run. I don't normally look like that.
You look good.
But, you know, yeah, you have to go into something you love you have to have passion for some reason. And my passion in this is I really like feeling well. And if I don't do certain movements, it's very hard for my back to feel like it's participating in the rest of my body. It just feels like its own standalone, angry, doesn't want to participate system if I don't figure out ways to make it integrate into the rest of my movements. And for me, that's foundation training.
And where did your disc or potential disc fusion surgery, where did that come from? Was it from a sport injury? Was it chronic? How did that come about?
I played a lot of ice hockey and a lot of water polo as I was growing up and into college. And then once I was in college, started sitting a little bit more. And I loved working out. I was a big, big guy. I liked being strong. Did a lot of deadlifting, a lot of squats. So there was this kind of subtle mechanical breakdown. I didn't pay attention to form in the way that I've learned to over the years. And I think that I was hurting myself without realizing it for many years. And back would go out a little bit at like 19. You know, it hurt. Maybe I'd have to sit down for a little while, but it wasn't major. 23, 24, once I began chiropractic school, it was hell. I would sit for too long and it would break me down. It really hurt. You know, it was the legitimate disc injury that people start to feel. But I still sat for another few years in chiropractic school. And if you fast forward now to 27 and a half years old, that's when I was told, hey, your back is so broken down that it's become unstable. We have to fuse these two vertebrae together to offer you a more stable environment so you can move through the rest of your life with stability. And it's like, man, that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, I get what you're saying. Like, yeah, build the bridge and go over it and pass over it. But what does that do for the environment of the muscles in the spine? And number one, stability is not from joints and bones. It's from the muscles and tendons that connect those tissues that are active and elastic and pull you together. So that didn't jive with me square away. I didn't get the surgery, and it became this very rebellious mindset. I've since gotten over the need for such intense rebellion against kind of my system and my community. And now I've just fallen in love with seeing people learn to connect their bodies in a very, very specific way that I teach and get a lot of benefit from it. It's let me meet a lot of people that I never would have met otherwise, and it lets me hear that I should know about Stuart McGill, which I do, and I respect him very much. But I love that our work has found its way into that same community. And it's through people like me who had a bad back, and then we taught them a few things, and they started getting better.
So that is interesting. You do have a very different way of looking at the back. So can you explain to us the sort of your method and how that came about? And maybe, you know, if you want, talk about how it does differ a little bit from Stuart's practice, because most people, especially our audience, knows Stuart's stuff well and has kind of understood it. But yeah, there are those subtle differences and big differences between your methods.
Yeah, I'll do my best to do that.
Okay, thank you.
So my view of the back, I'll go into mine first. I know that one well. The thoracic curvature is clutch and key in my work. And a lot of people have a tendency to shorten their spine by breathing in a very shallow state that involves their abdomen more than their rib cage. And particularly when they breathe into the rib cage, the front of the ribs tends to expand easily, and the back of the ribs, which is significantly much more important, tends to not contract. It tends to not participate. So they get this 180-degree breath at the ribs. take the breathing out of it for a moment. And at the same time, their shoulders are kind of weighing them down a little bit in the front, like they're wearing their shoulders like a jacket, sort of close in on their clavicles. And their clavicles start to aim down a little. And I'll show you my profile for a moment. You know, they go from a strong position to like leading themselves with their nose and jaw a little. And it's this anterior head carriage that yields less efficient spinal stability, sort of from there down. So what we teach people is how to connect these muscular movements, external rotation of the shoulder driven by the large posterior capsule muscles, lats that support the shoulder. You go down the hips a little bit and you start to see these hips that are chronically externally rotated, like you're still sitting while you're standing.
Hmm.
And what comes with that is this shortening of the glute tissue chronically. And muscles hate to go from short to shorter. They like to go from long to short, as they're meant to. And then actually under resistance from short to long as well. So we've had to come up with these fixes, these remedies to those common problems. Well, the common problems being the shoulders kind of a weight on the ribcage, the back of the spine hyperextending near that posterior back edge of the ribcage, creating this front flaring in respiration that shortens the back of the spine. And then the third is this chronic external rotation of the hip joints that shortens the glutes and makes us walk with our lateral quadriceps and our adductors, the groin muscles. And it's an inaccurate range of motion. It's healthy in many ways, but it's also unhealthy in many ways. And the unhealthy leads to pinpoint force dispersion while we're standing and sitting at usually L1 to L2 or L4, L5, S1. The lumbar spine seems to become the platform, the narrow, small, centralized platform on which the weight of the torso is absorbed.
Right.
Take that into movement, it hurts. Hmm. It breaks us down. It's inaccurate. You guys, anybody that's in a CrossFit world or in a weightlifting world, you know the significance of reasonable glute contraction and adductor contraction, and especially medial hamstring contraction as a lever that literally lifts your torso. Does that make sense when I say that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
To a lot of people, it doesn't. They use their lower back for that same leverage point because it continuously loses the tug of war against the hamstrings and glutes. So my idea with movement is very simple. Those are your weak points. I don't care how strong you are. Those are your weak points. The lower back musculature has to be able to endure a strong tug of war for the hamstrings. The shoulders have to be able to endure the weight of themselves pulling back instead of passively being stretched by the weight of themselves pulling forward. And most importantly, the skull needs to be behind the shoulders and above the shoulders, not entirely in front of the shoulders. And when you make those changes, as we do with every exercise and foundation training, you make those changes.
And the training is it mainly resisted training, or do you do some passive stretching? Do you do some mobility and tissue work, or is it just strength work?
It is only, I would call it durability.
Yeah.
There is a strengthening component, but we're ultimately trying to get muscle chains to connect together, which actually makes the muscles not have to do as much. It's a shared force dispersion, particularly on the posterior chain, hamstrings, glutes, lower back muscles, things like that. But it's all body weight, pretty much all barefoot, wear what you want. It's like yoga with obsessive compulsive disorder.
Right. And give us an example of how this exercise is working and maybe how traditionally people would try and fix it. So I'll give you an example. Like obviously most people, when they go, oh, you got bad posture, they do like some kind of shoulder isolation work. So band pull apart, rotator cuff training, they might do some. Maybe like some nods with the skull to kind of strengthen the back of the neck and the deep flexors of the neck. How would you approach, say, like someone that's got, oh, you know, you got bad posture, you got to pull those shoulders back?
I would ask them to work with me for a moment and show them how to do all the things that you just spoke of in the same pose. Hmm. And then I would add, from that isometric that we ultimately come to, which is going to be an opener for the shoulders, a lengthener for the neck, a proper guide for the skull, the jaw will be able to relax into a healthier position. The hands will be externally rotated in an anatomical position. The hips will be pulling towards center from three points of contact on the feet, the ball joint of the big toe, the ball joint of the small toe, and the heel. All of that is going to pull centrally towards the middle of the pelvis. From there, I'm going to teach you how to do something called decompression breathing, which is the dynamic portion of our exercises. You're going to hold this isometric, and then you're going to breathe very powerfully in 360 degrees at the rib cage, not at the abdomen. We're going to teach the diaphragm how to be pulled away from by all the muscles that surround the rib cage, and that's your exercise. That's your challenge, is to do usually 10 decompression breaths per pose. And the idea is that, and I'll get into kind of the jargon, and then we can make it sound however you guys want to make it sound, whatever makes sense. But my favorite phrase to use is that the general theory of foundation training is the re-education of the axial skeleton towards expansion, so that the appendicular, the appendages, can pull tighter against a larger, more broad, more evenly dispersed base. It lengthens the spine, it broadens the rib cage, and it lengthens the skull on the neck. When center feels strong, the moves outside of that, the distal movements, become much, much more clean, much more accurate. Something I think Stuart McGill expresses extremely well, and his exercises perform that very well. Proximal power, distal control.
So you're getting people into the right position, and then that gets the right muscles working, and then you try and teach them to breathe once they get into that position, basically.
Exactly. That's how we set the pattern, is with frequent movement. Respiration is what we do all day. If you can identify a little change that can be made in your breath, make that change whenever you're paying attention to it, you know, not all day, but whenever you're up, oh, there it is. Okay. Do the thing. All of a sudden, you know, you're doing that. You're making a 2% change on 10,000 breaths a day. If you start getting good at really paying attention, 20,000 breaths a day. And that's how neurology works. Neurology wants a pattern. And it's with that repetition of a pattern that it is ingrained and it becomes something that your body just does. That's an integration. And when you integrate these, when you integrate the decompression breath process into your life, it doesn't look like this big training tool that we use. It looks like the baseline of your respiration having a bit more biomechanics. That's okay. And for a lot of people, that makes a big difference.
How long would it take for someone to, let's say someone who does a little bit of training, so they're not, you know, completely off the couch, to get some awareness and sort of be like, you know, you're cueing them, you're behind them, you're like, I breathe into my hand or whatever, or breathe into this part of your spine or whatever it might be, or your torso. How long do you find it normally takes for someone to learn that? Is it a few weeks? Is it 5 seconds?
Yeah. You know, it's both of those.
Okay.
There's some people that just have this natural kinesthetic ability. They've got proprioception built in. They've never been taught to focus on it. But the moment they do, they got it. Okay, do this, do that. Okay, I can do that. Some people don't have that awareness, and what you have to do for them is literally develop a step-by-step awareness. Kind of hold their hand and say, breathe right here. You know, you put your hand on the back of their ribs, you do this little, like, spread the ribs a little, right there. That's where I want you to breathe. They might have to do it 100 times. They might not get it, by the way. Like, I don't want to give your audience the impression that this is a cure-all. I wish it was. I'd be a wealthy man. It's not. It's pretty good for a lot of people. And the kinesthetic awareness. I'm sorry, I just got an incoming call somehow.
No, all good. Keep going.
Okay, so the kinesthetic awareness comes eventually. For some people, it happens fast, but no matter what, no matter how good of an athlete, no matter how good of an athlete you are, a little bit of paying attention to certain pieces of breathing, certain pieces of foot position, certain pieces of hip position, and especially the way that your head pulls off of your neck as opposed to the way that it rests on your neck is going to make you a subtly better athlete. I've seen that across the board with many professionals, many Olympians, many world champions.
Do these faulty, like this faulty posture, do you see this in inactive folks? So people that just like don't train very much, or just regular people, people that train all the time, and then all the way to an elite athlete that probably spends most of their time training and not most of their time sitting at a desk? Like, do people still have the same faults of, you know, turned out feet and rolled their shoulders rolled forward and what you mentioned?
Not everybody, but it's certainly the majority rule. It's certainly the 80% rule. You know, 8 out of 10 people do, and it doesn't really matter what they do for a profession. It's more that they are also looking at phones. They're also sitting in a car. They're driving to work. They're sitting on their couch. That's what they're doing. So as a result of that, yeah, pretty much everybody's got some form of this pattern. It's what's interesting is it's expressed as hyperextensions, hyperflexions, and set joint impingements, and also femoral nerve. It hits both sides, and people kind of rest into their bodies differently. But ultimately, it seems once you hit your 20s, especially late 20s, you seem to be resting into your body substantially more. And we start to see those degenerative points begin to form.
What do you mean resting into your body more? Can you explain that?
Sit up as big as you can. Take a massive deep breath. Pull your shoulders away from each other. Really, not retract. Yeah, exactly. Pull the shoulder joints away and lift the base of your skull up.
It's like we're doing a lat pose.
Right. Yeah. It's like you're doing a lat pose or a most muscular.
Yep.
Now, take the intensity away, but stay in that seat. You know, stay where you are. Exhale, breathe regularly, but keep that subtle tone and relax the muscles into the pulls that you're doing. You'll notice that your shoulders remain open. You'll notice that your diaphragm is a little bit more engaged. Your obliques and abs and lats, everything's more engaged, yeah?
Mm, yes.
Now, come to a point where you can sit like that calmly with as much of the integration as you can have, but without thinking about it. Okay, and just take a deep breath, relax. Don't think about your posture, and then completely rest. And you'll notice the difference between resting into ourselves and not. Continue remembering throughout life, and it should. I don't teach people to sit like that all day. I teach people to sit like that for a moment or two at a time, so that it reminds them what it feels like to be supported.
Right.
That's. Remind a little bit.
So it's more like by the time you reach that late 20 stage, the accumulation of all the sitting at a desk and driving in the car and being on your phone is now like becoming more permanent and more the normal than how you should be.
I think that's exactly what it is. I think that was actually a nice, very eloquent way of putting it.
Mm.
The adaptive shift is beginning to occur in the favor of technology.
Mm. And if someone's not getting pain and they have the heavy anterior head tilt, which pretty much has got to be everyone listening to this podcast, right? They're either driving or they're on their phone. Everyone has it to some extent. What, without the pain, obviously we just established that we are inhibiting some level of athletic performance, but put that aside, what are we doing structurally to say just overall, just negative damage? Is it limited breathing? Is it headaches? Is it affecting our vision? Have you kind of thought about that before with just that slight anterior tilt the whole time, even if we're not at the pain stage yet?
I think, depending on... Let me start that with less stuttering. Depending on how many, what kind of pressure is forward and what kind of nerve it's hitting, it seems that whatever nerve is being compressed a little bit, and that could be kind of far away from the source of the nerve or closer to the spine or higher up in the spine, even in the brain stem. There's soft tissue and hard tissue meeting. Basically, as soon as the brain becomes the brainstem, there's this part of the skull that it goes through. And there's something called a Chiari malformation, actually. That is that tissue of the brainstem being pressed upon by the bone around it. And Chiari malformations come up with all sorts of symptoms, from coordination problems to learning disabilities to breathing disabilities because the phrenic nerve is nearby, to digestive disabilities because the vagus nerve is nearby.
Mm.
And so that's above the spine. I think that what leads to these things is the degree of compression. And yes, there's a psychosomatic component to it, because eventually when you get hurt too much, it hurts, man. You get sick of it, you get tired, your energy's down, you're negative. You're not fun to be around as much. But ultimately, I think that what compression does is it excites nerves. And an excited nerve gives a worse transmission, a less accurate transmission. So depending on the level of the spine that's under that bony on soft tissue compression, you're going to see all sorts of different symptoms from visibility issues, sure. Well, every time, no. But sometimes, yeah, everybody expresses symptoms differently.
Mm.
You're going to have, I don't know that you're going to get as many hearing difficulties. I think that can have to do with sinuses. That can have to do with so many things. That kind of gets into the woods of what's really causing it. But I think for basic symptoms, everything from respiration, digestion, visibility, touch, and feel can be affected throughout the entire body by nerve compression. And I think that everything has the ability to be improved upon by decompression type therapies. I also don't think that decompression has the ability to be pinpointed on certain spots. I think that it's going to be shared among the spine no matter what. So it's like you should get really good at learning how to decompress your own spine to the best of your ability so that you're not trying to find your L4, L5. I'm going to pull off L4, yeah. L5. Like, no, you're not. But what you can do is you can literally pull all of the tissue in the rib cage and the obliques and the abdomen, all of it away from the center, lengthen it, push it away, and just create as much space around the spine as possible in all the different areas. With space comes length of muscles. With length of muscles comes healthier contraction of muscles. So the support comes through that, through the development of durability and strength along those kind of multifidi muscles, and that really deep, deep, deep musculature, and then the bigger ones that surround it. But ultimately, any decompression therapy, any symptom reduction therapy for chronic pain needs to have a very active patient component where every day they're practicing a little bit of something that moves them in the same direction that their therapy is trying to.
Hmm. So with that being said, almost the value of massage is only there as long as you are coupling it with daily decompression work.
The sustained value, yes.
Yeah.
There's a short-term value.
Of course.
For sure. But if you really want the long-term assistance in healing, yeah, you got to do something.
Hmm.
You have to. I mean, who do you know that's healthy that doesn't do anything?
Yeah. Yeah. Probably just Peter Thiel or Elon Musk, but that's because they're injecting the blood of fucking 12-year-old boys into them.
Incredibly fit 12-year-old boys.
Okay. What, so if we're looking at potential environmental solutions for us to improve, just some of these symptoms, obviously sitting is a big one that comes to mind. Figuring out how to use our phones and our technology in a way where we're not constantly just in a forward head tilt. Have you found any particular sitting styles? Like, we've used a kneeling chair once, we tried the Bosu balls, or any of this sort of stuff that you found helps with the sitting? And then have you found anything besides just not using it as much that helps with the phone? Is there like
Google Glasses? That's what you need.
Is there a correct position to hold it, or do you just need to set your shoulders when you use your phone?
Or you just use Siri so it sits in your pocket.
Yeah.
Oh, I think with the phone, anything that you do is going to help a little bit. You catch yourself looking down at it. My wife catches me all the time and tells, I tell people how to stand up and live, and move for a living, and she catches me all the time.
Yeah, okay, we're human.
Lift your head up, buddy.
Yeah.
So what you got to do is put the phone down, and it's not how you sit it so much as practicing healthy postures that make you recognize when your body is in a bad position. Ultimately, that's what we teach. We teach sensitivity. Foundation training and things like Dr. McGill's work. There, and many, many others. I keep going back to this. Dynamic neuromuscular stabilization, functional range conditioning, Esther Gokhale's work. All of them have major value. All of them. But what they're all teaching is sensitivity. Hey, you may not know it, but right now you're in a position that's hurting you. Nuh-uh. Yeah. Practice this. Eventually, they realize, that's what it feels like to feel strong and supported in that same posture. Eventually, they start to recognize, thank you. Eventually, they start to recognize that they repeat that themselves enough, and they start to really notice what feeling bad feels like in those same postures. There's a shift that occurs over like a month or so, or a few weeks or whatever, where they practice feeling good, feels good. Then they go back to feeling kind of not as good. They practice feeling good, they start to balance out equal amounts of feeling good and feeling bad, and then very quickly it starts to shift towards control and autonomy, and being able to notice when they feel bad so quickly that they feel good. And that's the big, big, big shift. It's not sit this way or that way. It's exercise so well, and keep your form so well throughout every movement you do in life that when you're out of form, you recognize it. Because that's what we are, as human beings, we are designed to keep a certain range of forms. And it's when we get stuck in certain ones for too long that we get certain symptoms, it seems. So we might as well get good at getting out of those forms and staying in the healthy ones.
Mm. How do you, with that being said, people, are thinking, hey, does that mean I have to set up for a deadlift every time I want to pick up a pen off the ground, right? How do you, deal with that? The spine, needs to move in all directions safely, right? Yeah. And a lot of people, they do so much deadlifting or back setting or whatever, they get obsessed with it. And then the second they're out of position, they get an injury.
Yeah, not good.
Yeah.
That's, you don't You don't want to be linear.
Right.
That's what I would call that, is you're linear. You only have one way to move, and when you're out of that line, you're in trouble. It's dangerous for you. You have to have spiraling lines connected in your body. We're built on twists and turns, not straight arrows.
Right.
And with those twists and turns comes lots of training modalities. If somebody was to only do foundation training, they'd look very awkward, and they would only hinge. And they'd only move in this linear pattern eventually. You have to learn that, yes, you do hinge to pick up a pen. You don't set up for a deadlift, though, because that's obnoxious.
Yeah.
And make it hip-centric.
Right.
And be so stable in your external rotators, internal rotators, fine, intricate, smaller muscles of the foot and toes, all the way up to the large, powerful muscles of the groin and pelvis. Be so connected in there that you can go left, right, straight, backwards, forwards, and you're okay. Just pick the pen up.
Mm.
Don't worry about it. You know, pick the kid up. Don't worry about it. But it's because you've trained multiplanar. Do you know who Pat McNamara is?
No.
He's a well-known guy over here in the States, and he has a program called Combat Strength Training. And he gave a great quote that I probably heard a million times, but from him it makes a lot more sense because he lives it. Strength and power live in the transverse plane, and they do. They live in rotational capacity. And rotation begins at the hip joints. So you have to really train lots of different patterns of hip movement, lat control, lat stability, arm movement under lat control and lat stability. You start to connect a lot of dots in there. But ultimately, you have to have a lot of training modalities. You don't have to go and do training every day. Like you don't have to go to the gym every day. You don't have to do that. But you have to have lots of things in life that challenge your body in various angles. If you don't hang on things a lot, hang on things a lot. Start climbing. Start. Suck at it for a while, and eventually you will have a wonderful range of motion that you don't have right now. You'll have spinal support from like a whole different end of the body that people don't tend to have. You know, just start doing things that aren't just straight ahead. If you're a triathlete and you've been a triathlete forever, start playing water polo. Instead of just swimming in the water, tread in the water. Get your hips doing the egg beater. Things like that. Just start changing the position. Start changing the direction. Change the challenge, and your body will respond really well.
Yeah, so I guess along those lines, you're a fan of, you know, stuff like the Ido Portal method, where he does explore all different ranges of the body.
Yeah, Ido's got good work, and all the people he learned from have good work as well. I know some of his students very well, very closely. We share some students. And as a result, yeah, his work will take you very far. As far as you want it to, actually. It's limitless. But you got to protect yourself doing that work.
Yeah, that was sort of my next question, is they get into some pretty extreme positions for their back, especially this back bending, hollow back, crazy handstand shit. If you get strong in those positions and you hit those positions, right? You have to be strong to hit those positions. Is it so extreme, though, that they are, because they're young and they're strong, getting away with it now and later they're going to be paying for it?
Yes.
Okay.
Just blanket statement.
Right.
And I'm sorry, and Ido Portal, if you don't like that statement, I know deep down you agree with me. And you have to help people understand the value of protecting their spine down the line. Does that mean they shouldn't get into those movements? Of course not. Of course not. Do those movements. But also have remedial strength training, not just range of motion. Remedial strength training will keep you doing that stuff well beyond your 20s. So you can keep going deeper and deeper and deeper into the movements. But if you're only practicing those movements and that's your training, you're going to go too deep and you're going to hurt yourself. Not because I said so, just because of gravity and wear and tear and occasional dehydration on the wrong day when you're training a little bit too hard, hitting the wrong connective tissue. That's it. You know, it's not because of anything other than concentration gradients and tissue boundaries over time. I've just seen too many people that could do everything and then can't do anything, you know? And like, there's like a decade in between.
Yeah.
Long. You know, you gotta train for longevity. And I know his training is for longevity. Done well, done with all the versatility that he uses and my friend Summer O'Black uses and that crew uses, you're gonna train for a very long time. It's just, you have, if you're into the movements and you're going for those ranges of motion, you have to understand those guys train 6 hours a day. day, and they devote their life to rehabilitation as well.
Mm.
Is remedial training, is that, I haven't really come across that term, is that just like squats and deadlifts and your more basic training?
I don't know, it's just the word that made sense to me. It's not anything, there's no resistance other than your own body weight remedial, and what I would consider the remedial training, meaning it's the remedy to the other training.
Right.
Meaning that everything else in the world sort of pulls resistance from the outside into the body. So to me, remedial training would be that postural work that creates the 180 degree outward from the center of the body outward to meet and absorb all of those from the outside of the body in forces. So remedial training is the decompression breathing and decompression therapies we're talking about. It's ranges of motion that make a joint move as well as it possibly can under its own weight. No squats, no kettlebells, not right now, not for remedial training. I'm going to start using that term. Not for the intuitive musculature learning how to be more intuitive. Multifidi, intertransversari, the obturators of the pelvis. Nobody ever hears of obturators. Everybody should know about their obturators. Very, very important. They keep our pelvis very stable. It's like a gimbal for the...
gimbal.
I know so little about that word. I can't even say it back to you.
Yeah. Obturator.
Obturator.
Obturator. No, Raf's got a speech impediment, so don't get him to pronounce anything too hectic. Another thing that we came across a while ago, and I think it's always an interesting question for back experts is, I guess we've had on the podcast before, who does have really interesting work, Julian Pinot. He's really big on sandbag training, and he uses long carries in his training to build up or to help rehab people that have back issues, chronic back issues. Now, we started using these a lot in our own practice, and what we started to find is we would do these long sandbag carries. Say we'd take like 40, 50 kilos or whatever, 80, 90, 100 pounds, and we'd walk as far as we can with it. Usually we end up somewhere around 300 to 400 meters. But the reason we stop is because our back is completely blown up to the point where the pump is so ridiculous that I don't know if I'll be able to pick the bag up for 10 minutes. Now, we've had a lot of different discussions on this, and I'm curious to get your opinion, but it seems like some people are thinking if you push it that far, it's always bad and that you are causing some damage. And some people are thinking that it's just, you've just really cooked the muscles to that point that they've sort of just hit their version of failure. And it's just like, rest and start again. Because really, the rest of the day, you're not really feeling your back.
It
goes away, yeah.
Of course it does. It's a pump. It's like you did bicep curls and then you rested.
Mm.
It's great. Do those. Yeah.
Right.
If you feel it in the center of your spine, if you feel that same burning sensation and it's very centralized, and you're getting any kind of symptoms, no, that's bad for you. You might be doing it in the wrong position. But if you can walk with 100 pounds, you can walk with, legitimate weight, get to the end of it and feel pretty much a muscle pump, that's healthy for you.
Okay.
That's good.
Right.
It's good to know.
Yeah. We've been doing a lot of them, so it is good to know.
That familiar burning sensation will be felt through pretty much every single FT exercise.
Yeah.
It's exhausting. Our work is tremendously more difficult than it looks.
Right.
As bigger you are.
And how hard is it to learn your stuff by yourself without a coach?
It's definitely better to learn it with a coach. Most of our patients, though, don't. We have a streaming website that, a lot more people than I'll ever be able to see in person are using. And the vast majority seem to be getting better. Of course, we hear about people who don't, but they're rare. And they're usually somebody that tried once very quickly and then didn't go back to it. And our work is very subtle. It's difficult to learn for the first few weeks. But if you take your time and you let us walk you through the way that we have these programs planned, don't go too far too fast. Don't try to be a stud. This isn't stud work. This is adaptation and learning. So you go slow. You'll feel good. You'll learn it. And then if you go work with an instructor, you'll learn it better. And you'll support one of our instructors, which I really appreciate. We never make a dollar from our instructors. They get everything. And we're trying to help all of them start their small businesses or big businesses and roll forward. We have instructors. We have about 1,000 now, just a little bit over 1,000 in 31 countries. We just finished our first ever international certification course in Australia, where I got back yesterday.
Nice.
It was awesome. It sold out. It was great. Everybody was very happy we did it. Kulangata.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Got to surf rocks every day. I was a happy man.
That's good. Nice. That's why you got that warm tan going. It's very hot right now. So I wanted to come back to something you said earlier about hydration. I think it's probably one of the secret killers of a lot of people's spines. They don't realize they train heavy in the morning. They've had a cup of coffee. They haven't had water for 8 hours. They jump out of bed. Within 10 minutes, they're trying to set a new PB on the deadlift. What's your general protocols around hydration and heavy training and the time of day and that sort of thing?
I'm not an expert on heavy training.
Okay.
You know, but on hydration, I've found that everybody feels better when they're hydrated, you know,
of course. It's
really hard, really difficult to overhydrate, especially if you're training, if you're sweating it out, if you're sweating a little bit every day, it's hard to overhydrate. So I think that what people need to recognize is their hydration is basically to the level of the day prior, more or less, especially at the disc level, especially along the spine and along those deeper muscles. It's not instant. It has to be absorbed into the bloodstream, passed through kidneys. It has to be slowly absorbed into the different tissues of the spine, especially there's very little vasculature at the deep spinal level. So hydration happens very slowly, and it's you just have to be patient with it. Best thing you can possibly do is just stay relatively hydrated. You know, don't go more than an hour or two without a legitimate water. You know, if you need to have a little bit more salt in your diet, have it. Check your hydration on a regular level. If you're peeing yellow, honestly, you're probably dehydrated. If you're training, if you're a person that goes to the gym on a 5 days a week basis and you're trying to improve your performance, you should never be peeing yellow.
Mm.
And so if say you go out and you drink alcohol, whatever, the day before, is it generally like you're almost done on the disc level to be hydrated for training the next day if you dehydrated yourself?
Alcohol only dehydrates us if we're on the borderline of being dehydrated. Not like it goes into your system and water is literally, get out of here. You know, it's just it has the tendency to be a diuretic. So you pee a little bit more, you just eliminate a little bit more. Same with coffee. So if that's coupled, if you're having alcohol and coffee every day, you got to drink a lot more water, a ton more than most people. At least like 20-30% more than most people. And if you're not, just make the change today and you start feeling a little better, especially in the morning. Probably start sleeping a little better too. Just don't drink all the water like an hour before bed, because then you're not in the morning.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I have trouble saying what's bad for people all the time. I think that if there's a few basic tenets that if you follow them, you can do a lot of stuff that your body needs to detox, and it will have all of the tools to do it healthfully. So if you're going out and you're having a beer, whatever, fine. If you're going out and you're having like 8, you probably shouldn't train the next day. Probably just take the day, drink a lot of water, have a couple broths, you know, heal yourself, and then train the next day. It'll be better for you overall. Both of those things are major. Having a lot of booze in the system is a major stressor on the body. Having a big training session is a major stressor on the body. We got to start balancing out our stressors to make sure that we heal well. We've got energy for everything.
Yeah, it's funny. I've always had this rule where, like, if it's funny because people always want to train the day that they're about to go out and have a big night, right? Because they're thinking I got to get a pump for the club. But then, second, this sounds like a joke, but it's not. But secondly, you're going to feel so guilty about what they're going to do. They need to train especially hard that day. But my logic and my understanding of the science and having, you know, done this for so long has always been, why would I do that much damage to my body in a training session and then go out and put more toxins in my body and then eat how I'm not going to eat and not sleep as much as I'm going to sleep? That's going to make me even worse off. So it's better in that 48-hour window to not train either side of it. It's generally been my rule. Do maybe a little bit of a walk or whatever, get the blood flowing, that sort of thing the next day, maybe get some sun, chill out. But that's been a formula I've used, and honestly, it's helped so much more. Whereas the next day, someone's done a heavy leg session, they haven't had much sleep, they've drunk heaps, they walk around like, oh, I'm so sore, I shouldn't have trained, that sort of thing. It doesn't make sense.
I mean, you're right on that. I've never, the whole guilty training thing is like a weird self-inflicted self-flagellation that's publicly accepted.
Yeah.
Training is to bring joy to your life. That's why we do it. It's not, I mean, yes, there's an aesthetic to training. Cool. About 50 years ago, that aesthetic looked really weird, not really appealing, by the way. It's just culturally accepted right now to be a gigantic human being.
Not only accepted, it's really something to strive your whole life towards.
Yeah. Yeah.
The aesthetics are bananas, man. It's hysterical. But at the same time, look, I like to train. I like to look good. I like to feel good. But training is for joy. It's for the satisfaction of overcoming. It's for the joy of and euphoria that comes with all the hormone exchange. It stimulates your endocannabinoid system, which basically gets you high for free. Training is very valuable to us. If you're doing it out of guilt, there's something there. That's kind of that like dysphoria, that anorexia eating disorder style of punishing yourself for guilt for something that nobody's judging you on, by the way. Go drink. You know, do your, that's you. If that's what you're doing at this stage of your life, okay. There will come different stages in your life. But training for guilt, I've just never quite understood. And I come from a very guilty culture. You know, there's a lot of that here. Training makes you feel great. You should never taint that relationship. You should always look forward to challenging your body. You know, even, you know, that which you don't have to go run a marathon. Like, training can literally be the breathing that you're going to do for the next 20 minutes just to focus on breathing and feel well.
Yeah, it's so funny watching the evolution of people train and how they make that transition from, so you know, we have gyms and clients and stuff, and it does not happen very often, but occasionally, you know, you just see people become so obsessed with training, and then it doesn't become an enjoyment anymore. It just becomes this very brief moment of, wow, that was really hard, that was really fun, to very quickly, what's next, and can I train more, and how do I do this again? And it's just like, there, it's like impossible to satisfy. It's just like this craving that just cannot be satisfied. And it's, yeah, it's just a really tough conversation. And it's the same thing, right? It's just this, we're talking about a mental health issue at this point. It's got almost nothing to do with the training. And it's a shame because you're right. You taint the relationship. You take something which was such a joy and so enjoyable to something which is now, they don't see it as a negative thing because I'm training and I'm being healthy and stuff, but you can see it become a chronic issue with them.
I can only speak in my personal experience and what I've had with my friends and people that I've done this with for many years. My life changed at about 16 years old when I started going to the gym. I became a personal trainer the day I turned 18, literally. That was my birthday present to myself. Right when I started college, I was like, this is what I'm doing through college. I was a personal trainer through college. Became a strength coach. Went to chiropractic school. So all I wanted to do was how else can I feel good? You know, life is hard. How else can I feel well? I hate school. How else can I feel well? I'm going to a lot of school. I got to find a lot of ways. So training became this curiosity and this thing that just kept saving my life in many ways, my mentality, my mental health, my physical health, my relationships. That's my relationship with training. It's never been a straight line. It's had lots of peaks and valleys of intensity. And I think that when people become a little bit more okay with the valleys of intensity, they start to actually understand what training is a little bit better, which is not just push, push, push. There's so much pull for every push. And you got to train the pulls. There's both ends of the spectrum of strength, recovery and strength. The more we drive forward into strengths, bench presses and squats, deadlifts, the further we get away from the ability to just sort of be strong without resistance. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
So we are always seeking resistance, more resistance, more resistance. When we're kind of built with it. We have this system built in that we can actually relax into our resistance if held correctly, as you guys kind of felt briefly in the chairs there. You can learn to relax into support, relax into strength, instead of just pulling the shit out of it, you know, with all your might every time. How many guys and girls do you know that walk around like they're working out?
Yeah, a lot.
D's all the time.
Yeah.
That hurts. That gets tired. You have to foam. If you're like that, you have to foam roll every day. You know, you're always having to go to massage. You're always having to go to chiropractor. You're always having to take a pill. And eventually, you're always having to get something else to loosen up and relax. When with the same focus but less intensity, you can actually relax very well into that supported body. And I think people just should get closer and closer and closer to that type of health, especially if they always live in that sympathetic drive of strength, 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 strength. You got it. Yeah, there's another end to that. It'll probably make you stronger.
Yeah, it's true. It's very true. You need all training styles, but you know, some are just way less appealing on Instagram. And that's that's where a lot of people put a lot of value these days. So, yeah, it's funny. It's funny how it's making the shift.
In our main pose, the founder.
Yeah, we know it. Yeah, the overhead squat one.
Yeah, so the big awkward one where you just stick your butt out. Your arms. I mean, that's not an Instagram friendly pose, and it's much more popular.
Yeah.
But you still need to do that stuff. You still need to do the stuff that's not as physically appealing, because it makes you more physically appealing down the line. Like, you, it strengthens the right stuff down the line, so you can get more out of it.
Mm. Absolutely. I think this is probably a good time to transition. Final four questions. Mm. What are you? Awesome. Okay, so Eric, we've got four questions for you that we ask every guest. The first question that we have is, if you had an opportunity today to sit down and interview anyone, and they would answer any question you have openly and honestly, who would you sit down and interview and why? And they do have to be alive. So that takes out Michael Jackson and Jimi Hendrix.
And that guy you mentioned at the very beginning.
Yeah.
John Sarno.
John Sarno.
He'd be up on the list for different reasons. I mean, honestly, my parents, my dad.
Interesting.
You know, as I transition from, and I'm 38 years old right now, and I have a 15-month-old daughter and a wife and a business that's growing. And on the outside, foundation training is big. On the inside, there's four of us that run it. You know, and it's wild. None of us are businessmen, doctors, and firefighters. So I would sit down with him and I would ask him about, like, maturing from the son to the father. You know. Like, what certain things he did and what certain things I might want to avoid at all costs that he also did. So that would be my big question right now. Probably give him a call later today.
Mm. It is funny, hey? It is funny how, like, when you, you know, kind of have a different relationship, you're not living in the nest and you move out and you have your own lives and you see each other a lot less now. It's like, you're almost both thinking to yourself, you know, with your parents without actually saying it, we have way less time than we used to, and we're not getting caught up in, like, you know, did you take the rubbish out, or, like, did you clean your room and that sort of stuff. It's like, okay, now we're adults. What did you do when you were my age? Like, how do you, like, what plans did you have for your life that didn't shake out, or are you happy? Are you not happy yet? I think most people would find that more interesting than any other question or any other person they could talk to.
Yeah, I think that's the real chance right there. That's the thing. That's the life-changing advice from somebody that probably is very biologically similar to you. You know, if it's your same family. I probably would have given you a different answer a week ago, but when I was in Australia this past week, I got to spend time with my friend Martin Reeder, who just moved to Australia. He's an Olympian from Canada that is one of our instructors, and he came and taught the certification course with us. And he recently lost his father, and we had some interesting talks about that. It made me think a lot about the time that I'm lucky enough to still have with my parents. So that's where that one came from.
Nice. That's cool. Awesome. So next question is, what is something that you do every day, Eric, that you feel like is essential to the success of your day? So you'll do it when you're traveling, you'll do it when you're at home, you'll do it when you're in the office. What is that thing?
It's so cheesy and it's so biased, but it really is foundation training. It's allowed me to live the life I want to live. I do have a back injury, so if I don't do that work, I can't travel comfortably. I can't work comfortably. I can't really live all that comfortably. It supports me in a very good way. With the busyness of my life right now, I'd have to say, honestly, that just those decompression breaths and that focus on posture and on where is my body in space is very much one of the most important things that I can do.
Hmm.
And when do you do that? Is it first thing out of bed, or is it part of your workout?
How many times a day?
It's kind of throughout the day as I move around. Anytime I transition from one major thing to another, whether it's out of bed, I don't have to, like, plant my feet in a certain position anymore. I just kind of do the movement now real quick. It takes me 30 seconds, you know, and I kind of go through it, make sure everything's in line, and then move on. I usually will do it before bed too, just to kind of line up before I lay down. But it's that easy. It might take me a couple minutes total.
Hmm. Yeah, neurological nice.
Intensity.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. That's good. Awesome. And then the third question is, what is something recently that you held as a strong belief for a long time but have now changed your mind on?
Ooh, that's good. Let me think on.
You're going to move to Australia.
I'm going to give you a guide. No, I got home and my wife's already, like, I'm serious. Can we move there? Yeah, we might. There's a good lifestyle over there for folks like us.
Absolutely.
I'm gonna go to a really common one. I was gluten free for like 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out I was really screwing myself up.
Really?
You know, I'm pretty bummed about that, because what happens in a lot of the gluten free stuff is you don't just go and eat vegetables and meat. Then you go and you get gluten free bread and gluten free things that are made of these mixed gluten free flours. Mm. And we can't trick science. We can't trick the body. And we take all these different forms of carbohydrate in at the same time, in this very fine, easy to digest form. So we lose this mechanical process that burns calories and requires energy. And we just influx our body with insulin dumping carbohydrates of different forms that the body recognizes individually as molecules and reacts to individually as molecules. And I just started having these like gut issues and these energy rises and falls. And turns out I was really hurting my gut. My sugar was just up and down and up and down, because rice flour, tapioca flour, potato starch, all of those things secrete their own enzymes, or the body secretes its own enzymes to get those.
Yeah, yeah.
Not like a wheat flour that your body is recognizing this one thing. Well, there might be a gluten response to that wheat flour. At least it's one thing your body is reacting to if it is a clean version of it. I think the issue with a lot of carbohydrates that people have is this mixing of carbohydrates. More than anything else, I really think that if people started doing like a single flour for their bread, a single flour for their meal, versus three or four, you know, malted barley plus wheat flour plus all-purpose flour with that's so many things, too many things. So I was screwing myself up pretty good for like 4 years with things like that until I finally stopped. I went to a naturopath and got an absurd amount of blood work done, and I got healthier and my wife got pregnant. It was awesome.
What initiated the gluten-free kick?
Mental health, plain and simple. You know, I was all over the place when I was after chiropractic school. I was super intense. I was starting my foundation training stuff, and my back was still pretty messed up at the time. I was like 28, 29, and I was trying everything to feel better at that stage. And that helped. It helped my mental health at first for like a year, and then it actually took it the other way, and I became much more polarized as a result of it.
How did it help your mental health?
It just calmed me down. I think when you react to things from in the gut, it affects your mental health. Simple. I think your stomach really, what you digest has a lot to do with whether your body sees life as something to be anxious of or something to be relaxed in.
Hmm.
And for me, I was eating a lot of things that made me feel anxious when I was at that age.
Hmm.
More so than I ever did and ever have again.
Hmm. It's interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting analogy. I never really thought about it too much. Honestly, I've never been gluten-free, but exactly what you said. I generally try, and when I choose the carbohydrates, just go for, if they have gluten in them, like bread's probably the biggest one. I just try and always go for like really high quality breads, big sourdoughs, you know, things that go off very quickly. Like, you know, the breads that I get, if you leave them out for 2 days, like they're pretty much done. You got to eat them pretty quickly. Like that's how little preservatives they have in them. And I guess we're just lucky that we have brands like that and companies like that in Australia where we live that are creating those sort of products at a really affordable price, and they're mainstream now. So it's good.
That's yeah. Excellent.
It's good.
Yeah.
Better than fucking Wonder White.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is the killer.
Yeah.
Guys, my wife literally just whispered in the back. You can't see her. She goes, "That's another reason to move there."
Yeah.
Spot on.
I could tell. I sent you a bunch of photos from yesterday and in the nice weather and the beach and stuff. And yeah, that's all you need. So final question is, what is a book you would recommend for people? And if you do have one, a favorite quote of yours?
I would recommend Dr. Sarno's book, Healing Back Pain, to address your first question in the very beginning of the podcast. How much I believe it can be psychosomatic? It can be. And for a lot of people, it'll help you. So Healing Back Pain by Dr. John Sarno. And then in addition to that, well, I'm sorry, what was the second part of that?
Is there a favorite quote that sticks with you that you like?
Yeah, but it's probably from like George Carlin or something like that.
Okay.
You did have a good quote earlier in the show, and it was from your friend that you said resonated with you about like where the power, strength and power comes from the transverse plane.
Oh, from Pat McNamara. Yeah, that's not my favorite quote. Strength does come from the transverse plane. No, I would say I don't really have. I'm a little energy depleted right now after running and everything. I'm trying to think of something creative. If it springs up, I'll just shout it out. But right now, I would just say, you know, I got a good one from my buddy, Dr. Tim Brown, that I use. I teach this in my certification courses a lot. And he's a brilliant, genius-level sports medicine guy, a real pioneer in the field, very legitimate pioneer in the field. And Dr. Brown says that the body is not symmetrical. It's not. And what it really is it's designed to respond to these injuries quickly, flexibly. It's not symmetrical. The more you try to stay symmetrical, the more you're almost blowing yourself up, where really it's just reflexiveness. And we have to train our body to be as strong at the end of a range of motion as it is at the beginning of the range of motion and every moment in between. And if you do that quote of our body is not symmetrical, it's designed to respond to asymmetries, makes a whole lot of sense.
Mm.
Awesome.
That's good. Yeah, that's good. Because I spend all the time just trying to be symmetrical, but it never works. Awesome. Well, I think this was a very, very enlightening podcast. Yes. So Eric, thank you so much for being on the show. We greatly appreciate it. And where can people find out more about you if they want to follow you?
Just go to foundationtraining.com. We have a streaming website that's $15 a month, and it works most of the time. So if you want to support our work and what we're doing, that's the best way. We just finished a certification course in Australia where we had a couple people from New Zealand and a few other places, but I know that we have 21 new instructors in Australia right now.
Awesome.
This work will help most people. We have an instructor page, find an instructor page on our website, email info@foundationtraining.com if you want to find out if somebody is near you. But we did a nice big horseshoe along the coast of instructors. We have people from most major cities and a lot of small towns. I think total, we've got about 38 to 40 instructors in Australia right now. I'm trying to build that up as well as we can. But again, we're a small company. We do about 8 certification courses a year.
Hmm.
So slow and steady.
Fantastic. Well, Eric from the My Muscle Project, new studio, thanks so much for being on. And yeah, we'll speak to you very shortly. All right, guys, there it is. A fantastic episode with Eric Goodman from Foundation Training. Guys, remember, today was brought to you by True Protein. True Protein have the best tasting whey protein supplements in the entire world. If you go to trueprotein.com.au, you use the code MINDMUSCLE10 when you check out. You get 10% off any of the products at True Protein. And of course, guys, True Protein supplements are also found inside Peak Chocolate. If you want to get Peak Focus or Peak Active, you can head to peakchocolate.com.au and use the code MMP10 when you check out to get 10% off. That's it, guys. Thank you for listening to episode 232. We'll see you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/The After Show. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.